Three, two, 14. Recording.
Dave is editing today, so Dave, good luck with that.
Yeah, check out the 14.
I don't claim to keep time as well as Shane does. He's a natural rhythm maker.
He's just a guy.
All right, so really quick, before we actually get into it, these spoilers are hot fire.
Mm. Like lava.
How about we just kind of like slam through the PT in 15 or 20 minutes? Okay. Tops.
You know, to spend a lot of time on the spoilers.
We also don't have to do like a super long episode because Dave is the one editing in an effort to make his life as easy as possible.
Sure. So when Shane's editing, we want to make his life as miserable as possible.
I've always maintained that this is my position.
That's a really good, that's a good way to do it, you know?
I think so too.
Yeah. There's a hierarchy and all that stuff.
Yeah, and in the hierarchy, Shane is very much at the bottom of courtesies. And I expect the most courtesies personally, of course. Hello and welcome to episode 273 of The Dive Down, a Magic the Gathering podcast focused on the latest decks, trends, and strategies for the casual spike. My name is Stanislav here in Chicago, and with me on the line from the sixth smallest state by land area, it's the one and only Doomwake, aka Devin O'Donnell. Hello!
It's the sixth biggest state in my heart, okay? Just saying.
What are the five bigger states in your heart other than the one you live in?
I'll get back to you later.
Texas.
Well, yeah, I guess that's true. I am a Dallas fan, so
we have Texas. We've got
I've been to Florida a lot. I have a lot of history in Florida, so
hey, don't we all? A lot of history we'd like to forget. In my case,
true. Ooh.
I did see a manatee once, so gonna hold on to that memory nugget. You know what else is a memory nugget I want to hold on to for as long as possible? That sweet, sweet feeling of heavy play products in my hands. Mm.
Like the first time you opened it, it's like, it's bliss.
I'm like, what is this force, this invisible force that's keeping all of it together? Ah, yes, it's magnets. How did I miss the magnets?
Duh.
Heavy play, the card gaming accessory brand that's designed to improve your gameplay and your game day. Their playmats, deck boxes, and card sleeves feature enhanced ergonomics for mobility and protection. And most importantly, they've got the magnets in their special proprietary EquipMag system that you use to attach your dice bundles, your deck boxes, all to your playmat. Carry it around in a single hand at table one. They keep moving table one around at the tournaments.
Oh, so is that how it is?
You're at the top seed the whole way,
right?
But they're like, you know what? Table one is just going to be on the other side of the convention hall.
Mm.
And then the finals are at the Denny's next door because the LGS has to close. And you can just carry your heavy play EquipMag system everywhere you go in one hand. It's lovely.
The magnets are good enough for that. You can travel all the way to Denny's and your deck's not going to fall.
That's right. No matter how greasy their omelet is.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
Look, whether or not you like a greasy omelet at 1 in the morning during your RCQ finals, you can always get 10% off your first order at heavyplay.com with promo code THEDIVEDOWN2024. You're going to like the way you carry things in one hand. I guarantee it.
You're going to like the way you eat that omelet. We cannot guarantee, what we can't guarantee is that you get a discount at Denny's, though. So please don't go to Denny's and ask them for one.
Yeah, not yet, but I'm working on it. I'm working on my Denny's relationships. Speaking of omelets, Devin, I feel like one time you've told me that you make a mean one.
Yeah.
Is this true?
Well, I try to make omelets every day for breakfast.
Every day?
Yeah. It's just the way that I like eating eggs. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know why.
Same ingredients?
Yeah, it's just bacon and cheese.
Okay.
Kind of a plain
guy. Minimalist.
Yeah. I mean, when it's that early in the morning, it's like, I don't want a bunch of fancy stuff. Just give me the easiest ingredients, the stuff that's easy to cook. You know, I'm a simple guy. I gotta wake up first.
you know, a little green pepper and a little chopped onion, not that fancy.
Yeah, maybe a little chive on top.
Oh, love a little chive on top. Mm-hmm. I've actually been going around to stores to see if I can find a chive plant. Because really? I love putting chives on my egg products, actually. And I eat a lot of eggs as well. And chives are hard to find in plant form.
The secret ingredient.
Truly.
Not that secret now, but...
I've got another secret to spoil for you, Devin.
What's that?
Dave and Shane are gone this week, clearly. I haven't introduced them. They haven't spoken up.
We're just going to move on. Oh, no, that's not Dave. Sorry, that's my cat.
Your cat, whose actual name is... David.
True.
We
for
got
the record, I don't have show. A cat.
That's too, I've got a cat. Hopefully he keeps his mouth shut while we record. He's been loud lately. You and I have only done one one-on-one episode before. It's nice to just do the two of us.
Yeah, just a one-on-one. Just chatting.
We can talking about some truths.
Yeah, we see, this is the episode where we can talk stuff about, you know, Dave and Shane. With that, well, maybe not Dave, because Dave's editing it, but Shane, yeah. All the gloves are off.
Well, I'm allowed to talk about Dave. You are allowed to talk about Shane.
Okay.
If we cross streams, the politics will collapse on themselves, but I've got some Dave tea for you.
Oh.
So the fine folks at Wizards of the Coast sent me, very generously, true story, a box of sealed product. And we're going to do some fun stuff with the sealed product via Dive Down Enterprises soon. So watch this space. But I was dying to crack some packs and they sent me a booster box. So Dave and I did our quarterly, I guess it's more than quarterly. They put out sets a lot these days. But officially, Dave and I will frequently get a booster box to split, or we'll get one each and we'll do a bunch of little sealed tournaments against one another. Mm-hmm. Dave came over last week. We did our Thunder Junction Dive Down Dave or Stan sealed mini tournament. And I don't think he won a single game.
Oh boy.
Not one. I don't think. I'm sure he'll try to correct me next week when he's back, but
you know he's probably gonna cut that part of the episode out now that you've said it.
Okay, listen. I could not let this aggression stand from Stan. As usual, completely misremembering real events that have happened in the past. Let it be known, we made two different decks, two builds each. And yes, during the first build, I did not win a single game. He beat me, I believe, three games in a row. However, we made a second deck build, and I definitely won at least one game with that one. I think it was right as I was leaving. Defeated him fair and square. I think it had to do with Slickshot Show Off in my deck in sealed, and it worked. And if I remember right, the way that I beat him, in fact, was I got him to play a removal spell on my nearly lethal Slickshot Show Off. And then he tried to kill it, and I had one card remaining in my hand, and that card, friends, was Snakeskin Veil. And the Snakeskin Veil made it Xaxes. And then he died. So let's not get too greedy, Stan. All right, go on with the episode, you two.
Oh, God, you're right. It's going to make me sound like an idiot. It's going to pitch me up so my voice is even higher than it already is.
Yep.
That'll be funny. It'll be a good gag. I'll allow it.
It'll be a good listen on the drive this week.
We got to talk about this week's show.
What are we doing?
We were initially just going to talk about the Pro Tour and Standard, but then all hell broke loose.
They dropped a bomb on us.
Yeah, kablooey. Blake Rasmussen, friend of the show at this point, basically said, listen, those bad quality photos, they were actually kind of real. And we have some official Modern Horizon 3 spoilers today.
Oh, we do.
Blake is like, look at these nice card arts in high res. Don't look at those dumb spoiler, fake spoily, grainy razor phone.
It's like somebody's hand in the way. You can't even see the whole text box.
I don't understand how someone can take a photo that looks so bad in 2024. It makes no sense.
Yeah, I don't know. Part of me, maybe it's on purpose, where like they could take a higher quality one, but I don't know. You're right. It is kind of strange.
It's so strange. If it were me, and I'm not saying it was, but if it were me and I needed to cover my tracks, I would use my phone to take a picture of a card that I'm holding up to the reverse camera on my car. Ooh. So it goes through two lenses. And I think that's the way you make sure no one catches your deception. And maybe that's what happened this time around. But
what if you just go to somebody, like some random person's car, and you take a picture of it next to their license plate? You know, just like the card right on the plate.
That's a really good idea, too. It's just the perfect crime.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, on the dive down, our, you know, unspoken position is we only talk about spoilers that are official.
Yep.
We don't talk about leaks because you never know if the leaks are real. People play pranks on us all the time. But now the spoilers are true. They're official. And we're going to talk about those after the Pro Tour.
Yeah, the other thing about leaks too is that sometimes content creators get leaks, and if people talk about a card and more people know about it, you're kind of taking away from the content that that creator was going to produce. They have like this whole thing and spiel, you know, ready to go for their preview card, and if their preview card gets leaked, then, you know, it kind of sucks for them.
Yeah, it sucks for everybody, and we don't want to be a part of that crime against humanity. And we don't have to be, because the spoilers are official.
Yeah. No crimes committed here.
Well, except when we interact with our opponents in any way.
Sure. True.
We should housekeep really quick, because we do have a new patron to shout out. Nicholas C. Hello.
Nicholas C., thank you very much.
You're a proud member of the Dive Down Nation now.
Absolutely.
And your papers will be in the mail shortly. Certified. Sign on delivery.
Get a little token in there, too.
We also got a new review, and I don't know if I even want to read this one out loud,
but no, I must. No, why don't you?
Because it's, look at that nice token.
Look at that guy.
That's me.
That is you.
That's me riding on a rhino. Almost as good as your rhino token. Hey, we both have rhino tokens, dude.
True. That is true.
It's like a version of Eskimo Brothers.
This finally came in the mail.
Oh boy, that's hot. Look at that thing. That's hot.
Love to see it.
Anyways, we're diverging.
How many of those did you get?
That was the first one that I got because I purchased cards. I had to buy a slick shot. So I was like, I had to purchase cards. They didn't send me any. I could probably message Evan and be like, hey, can I get like 100 of those? Because I want to get some before I go to Dallas to have people sign.
Yeah.
Or have me sign. I'm not going to have people sign my token.
That would be really funny too. You give them to someone, but you insist that they sign it first. You have to have at least 8, because I'm assuming you play the playset of Crashing Footfalls.
You never have 8 in play, though. They always kill at least one of them.
That's true, and yet it's the power move.
Just have a giant stack.
You can always endurance back your footfalls. Make more rhinos.
Honestly, if they gave me 100 of them, I would just like, as I sit down at, you know, FNM or whatever, I just put the stack of 100 face up on the table. Like, yeah, we're going to be here for a while.
This is a battle of wits deck, of course.
Yeah.
Okay. Anywho, this new review from Walt something something. Walt did say we are the best magic podcast out there, which I agree with.
True. Walt is right.
Walt is right about that much. Walt also pointed out that they beat Stanislav's Is It in Soul deck on Arena. GG's from Watermelon. That stings.
The Watermelon or the in Soul part?
It's the losing to a fan. I hate losing to fans. I feel like it's my job to beat them as often as possible.
Oh, so I've read this as beat Stanislav's Is It in Soul deck. I didn't read this as beat actual Stanislav. Were you playing on Arena the other day?
I was playing in Soul on Arena.
Okay. Now it's all clicking.
Maybe it was someone else playing in Soul. And
yeah.
Watermelon, aka Walt, heard about this after me talking about them. I don't know. But I'm assuming he played me, because my name on Arena is Stanislav as well. Gotcha. Hard to miss.
Could be the other Stanislav.
Sivka? Yeah.
Yeah. You never know.
Or Tundoslav. who's actually been playing in Soul on MTGO. I pay attention to all the in Soul grinders who have the name Slav in their avatars.
Control F Slav.
Yeah. Okay. If you want to be like Walt, find us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Leave us a rating and review. If you want to be like Nicholas C, find us at patreon.com/thedivedown. Gets you into the Discord, gets you added swag. You can also support the show on our store at thedivedown.com/store. Just go to thedivedown.com. Like, the store is in the navigation. It's hard to miss. Get some Mana Traders discounts using the promo code thedivedown_K4L. And that's how you play the game. A lot of other people play the game this weekend at beautiful Seattle, Washington. Pro Tour Thunder Junction.
Thunder Junction.
Thunder Junction. A dust settled in the Pacific Northwest. Oko emerged from the Omen Path, here to settle the score once and for all at a competitive, standard, and limited tournament. So before we get into results, I just want to ask, curious to hear your thoughts on this, Doom. What does the Pro Tour mean for the Magic community these days? We've had a lot of ebbs and flows in competitive Magic. I think that up until recently, Standard wasn't really a focal point for players by and large. I think we've seen a lot of that change after the last RCQ season. The timing of the Pro Tour may be a little awkward because we're in Pioneer RCQ season, but we can potentially infer that Standard remains the most popular format in Magic thanks to Arena and maybe the general popularity of Standard at the moment. Does the Pro Tour still matter? Would people be excited if it was a different format, or more excited or less excited? What did the Pro Tour mean to you?
It's a really tough question to ask, or a really tough question to answer, rather, excuse me. I mean, at least for the people involved in the Pro Tour, it, you know, certainly means a lot to them. They're the people who are consistently doing well at the Pro Tours have, I believe it's something to do with adjusted match points, also known as AMPs, where if you get a certain number of AMPs, that qualifies you for the next one, and yada, yada, yada. There was one thing, a tweet that I saw specifically from, I don't know if you saw this, but Nathan Stoyer actually tweeted out, and because he didn't make day two and he had a poor performance, he's actually off the Pro Tour, which, you know, I mean, he was the world champion not too long ago, and to see somebody like him fall off, it's kind of wild. As far as the format itself, I agree with you. I had a lot of fun playing Standard during the RCQ season, and it's kind of really where I started to pick up Standard. I hadn't played a lot before then. Maybe if the Pro Tour... Well, the weird part to me is, you know, we'll dive into this with the metagame, but, you know, it was Pro Tour Outlaws of Thunder Junction, but a lot of the decks and that were highlighted on camera, especially the ones that were overperforming, the ones that did well, maybe didn't have that many Thunder Junction cards. And I think that was maybe a little disappointing. So that's kind of my big takeaway from the weekend, I guess.
I wonder how much of that Thunder Junction impact on the format had to do with either the time between release and this tournament, perhaps not enough for even like the most sophisticated testing teams to actually explore the new technology enough to decide whether it was worth running, or worse yet, like card availability.
Yeah.
I heard the tournament had one vendor that was announced like within the same week as the tournament itself.
Yeah, that was pretty rough. One vendor, and, you know, like you said, it was announced very, very late, so it's possible the vendor didn't even have the ability to get the requisite number of, especially the new cards. And what's also, you know, maybe tough about that is, and maybe we, you know, this is more of a big score thing, but like the big score is super rare. Those cards are hard to get. And if one of those cards end up being a breakout card of the weekend, it's pretty hard to find, you know, a whole bunch of copies of those because there's just not that many out there right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, fortunately, there were some new additions and new additions from Thunder Junction among the cards. We'll talk about what those are. But before we do, let's actually look at the overall metagame. It was shared by Magic.gg, the official news source of Wizards of the Coast Magic the Gathering tournaments, confirmed by Fireshoes, whom I trust more than anyone, really. And we got a full breakdown. There was a little over 200 players. most popular deck by a significant margin. Yeah. It was 31.4% of the field. 31.4% of the field. This is standard. So, like, I guess that makes sense, sort of.
Yeah. I mean, if you go back and look at some of the metagames from prior standard Pro Tours, that number wouldn't surprise you.
Okay. And that deck is Esper midrange. I think going into this tournament, it was considered by most the most popular deck in the format. Whether or not the strongest, definitely the most popular, and has been for some time.
Yeah, those numbers that I was talking about for prior standard Pro Tours, it's basically all Esper midrange. This deck has been the best. I think you could almost argue that it's been the best deck in the format, almost like ever since Raphine was printed. Like, that card's just completely messed up. And it's not surprising to see, you know, this many people bring it. The deck is extremely flexible. It has aggressive draws. It has a ton of, like, late game card advantage. It's got good mana now that it has Concealed Courtyard. It's just, there's basically nothing this deck doesn't have at this point.
The second most popular deck with only 10.6%. So that's like a 20% drop off. Boros Convoke, 22 copies. This did get a very important new card, and that was the red-white Fastland. And we all knew it was going right into this deck. I don't know that we necessarily anticipated that it would actually bring it up so high in the metagame share so quickly. But I guess cleaning up the mana probably made a big impact on the playability of this strategy in the format.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I definitely, like, I was joking because, you know, there had been talks about previous Fastlands and would they ever print the other ones. And I said it on stream at one point, I was like, literal best card they could ever put into standard was Inspiring Vantage, and they did it. And it was the actual best card. Like, it's just, you know, the mana was so atrocious. You had to play 3 in Portal and all these terrible lands. So huge printing for that deck.
With 19 copies, so just over 9%. Teamer Analyst, followed by 4 Color Legends with 17 copies. And then the fifth most played deck was Domain Ramp, just under 7%. Also shout out, the last deck that had over 10 copies was Azorius Control, just under 5%. And then beyond that, we see a smattering of, like, I think everything you would expect. Dimir Midrange, Rakdos, Mono Red, Golgari Midrange, Dimir Control.
Yeah.
A lot of black decks, but we got some aggression in there as well.
Yeah, like you said, most of what you'd expect. Nothing too crazy with, you know, new cards from Outlaws of Thunder Junction. These decks were already decks that were, you know, existed in the metagame before then. So nothing too surprising here.
Here's my question for you off the cuff. Let's say it's Thursday morning and Mark Rosewater calls you on the red phone in your office that only he has the number to, and he says, Devin, we've had a last minute cancellation. We need someone to play in the Pro Tour. Get your butt over to Seattle. I'm sending a jet your way. Rosewater's private jet.
Yeah.
No prep other than whatever time you have on the private jet. What are you playing in standard this weekend?
So the only prep that I have is just, like, whatever, like you said, time of the jet to look at deck lists and stuff for previous week or so.
Yeah.
I mean, I honestly haven't played a lot of standard for the past, like, maybe month or so, but I would have probably, you know, given that amount of time, probably Esper.
Mm-hmm.
If I had no time.
Yeah.
And I honestly, you bring up a good point. Like you said earlier, it's if these players maybe didn't have as much time as usual. I think the usual time between set and Pro Tour is like 17 days, and this time was only 10 days.
Oh, interesting. I didn't realize that.
I think
it was even that much shorter. Wow, yeah. Like a whole week shorter, basically.
Yep.
And I think, not surprisingly, the most popular cards in the tournament are reflective of all these black decks. Go for the Throat, Cut Down, Deep Cavern Bat. Top 3 most played cards across the whole Pro Tour. We do also know what some of the most popular new cards were, which I think is pretty interesting. The single most popular card from Thunder Junction to appear, or let me rephrase, the single most popular non-land card from Thunder Junction to see play at the Pro Tour was Pest Control, which was primarily a sideboard card in most cases. we knew it was going to be good and people were really gung ho about it. What's it good against?
That the second most played deck, Boros Convoke. Very, very good sideboard card against Boros Convoke. I don't think it's really good against much else, but it is really, really good. It's like almost lights out if you have it. Like if they have the draw that's like, you know, one draw Mythic Lethal Demolition and you just blow up their whole board, it's just game over.
Amazing. The next most popular non-land card was Rest in Peace, which is not technically a new card, but new to Standard. And I think we see that so popular because of the Analyst decks being like the graveyard combo. Is there any other graveyard synergies in the format right now that Rest in Peace is important against?
Not that I can really think of. Well, I guess the four-color Legends deck it is pretty good against because they're trying to loop Slowgurks and like Channel Lands and stuff. So it can be good against those decks. Not the end-all be-all because they can definitely beat it. Like they can just kind of attack through it. But past those two, not really a lot else, no.
Duelist of the Mind saw a lot of play as well. There's 97 copies. You know, speaking of Nathan Stoyer, had a card in the tournament. I don't know if he played it in his deck. Maybe he should have.
No, I think I saw tweets where people were trying to get him to put it in his deck, but he couldn't bring himself to it. I mean, I don't think the card's that bad. We saw, I think it was one of the Esper players who made top eight spoilers. I think they had three copies in their deck. So,
Three Steps Ahead was also really popular. The new counterspell across all the Azorius control lists. Followed by Honest Rutstein, which saw play in a bunch of decks, including Analyst and Legends. And then finally, the podcast's favorite new card, Slickshot Showoff. It was going pew pew, zoom zoom.
Yeah, I think that card translates a lot better to older formats because the density of cheaper spells is much higher, like Pioneer and Modern. But when you get into a format like Standard, there's not as many cheap cards to pair with it, so it's not quite as powerful as it would be otherwise.
We also got win rates from all the decks. Official win rate report with a matrix of basically how these decks stack up against the top 7 or 8 strategies in the event. And this was really interesting to me because the single most successful deck that had a 76.5% win rate in Standard construction only had two pilots, and that was Jund Analyst.
Dang.
So up to now, Analyst primarily a teamer deck. And for those who aren't familiar, essentially use a bunch of teamer spells to set up a card called World Soul's Rage, which is a fireball. Essentially, it's just like a big burn spell that you can sink mana into. And these two Canadian players named David Olson and Andrew Kidston, they registered the same 75 using black instead of blue to set up a combo. And the main draw toward black is apparently Pitiless Carnage, which is from Outlaws of Thunder Junction, which is a plot card that you sacrifice permanence and you draw that many cards. And you can plot it on turn 3 and then just kind of wait until you've set up a position later on where you have 4 new Capenna fetches in your graveyard and 6 basics on the battlefield. You tap your 6 lands for mana. You sacrifice them to a Pitiless Carnage to draw 6 cards. And now your graveyard will contain 10 lands total, which you then use a card called Splendid Reclamation or Aftermath Analyst to return them all to the battlefield tapped, undoing the resource loss of Pitiless Carnage, producing a ton of mana as well, especially if you have Spelunking online. Then all those lands would enter the battlefield untapped. They let you play and dig for maybe even more Pitiless Carnage to create this chain going. You're increasing your land count each time, and then you eventually sift through your entire deck, generate tons of mana, and cast the World Soul's Rage for 20.
20 is a lot.
I mean, that's how many you start with.
That is. Well, not EDH, but...
Yeah, well, we're not playing that Pro Tour yet.
That is, well, yet. Yeah, Pitiless Carnage is a really sick addition. I kind of hadn't thought, like, put two and two together and tried this. I never thought about this with Analyst and Wreck, but it's really, really sick, especially when you, like, I think, like, what you said, the Carnage loops that you're going into, if you start doing those loops with Nissa in play and the Spelunking, then you're just up infinite mana, and you can just, like you said, chain off and just kill them in one shot.
I want to try this deck, not going to lie.
It looks sick.
It looks really fun. Looks great in Best of One, too.
Yeah, no, rest in peace.
Yeah. The next most successful deck was another kind of new take, which was Orzhov Bronco. I feel like you know about this deck a little bit better than I do at this point.
Yeah, well, like I said, I haven't played a lot of standard and really any standard, but this is the one deck that caught my eye because I was looking at, like, I don't know why, but I was looking at Moto deck lists and I came across this one and I was like, holy cow, this looks really sick. So the goal of this deck it was played again by two people, Kevin Anktil and Ulysses Gagnon Parody. But the goal of this deck is, you're kind of just sort of like a regular Orzhov mid-range deck. You have your traditional, like, cut down, go for the throat, these other, like, Orzhov mid-range or, you know, other black mid-range cards. But you're pairing this engine with a new combo from OTJ. The combo is you have Caustic Bronco. It's the new Dark Confidant. People are calling it Caustic Bron Confidant or, you know, whatever. But it's basically 2/2 for two. When it attacks, you flip the top card. If it is, you lose mana value equal to its, to use life equal to its mana value. And if it's saddled, then you can have them lose life. So the goal is you have a Bronco in play. You cast another new card called Insatiable Avarice, which is a spree card. The two options are you can basically Vampiric Tutor to search your library for a card and put it on top, or you can have target player draw three and lose three. So you could do both. There's a specific card that is legal in standard. It is called Shadow of Mortality. I don't know if you're familiar with this card, but the only important thing about this card is the fact that it costs 15 mana. Mm-hmm. So what you're doing is you're going to cast your Avarice to put your Shadow on top. You're going to saddle your Bronco. And then when you attack, you flip the top card of your library and you say, you take 15, and then you actually throw the Shadow at them. It's part of the combo. I don't know if you know that. But yeah, you just try to one-shot them with Shadow, which is kind of cool.
Love it. Dope. I opened a Caustic Bronco in my Dave of the Dive Down mini seal tournament, and I thought of you because I knew that was a card that you really liked during spoiler season.
See, I told you. Told you.
You were right.
And this particular deck list, as far as the win rates are concerned, with those two pilots, 63.2% over the course of the entire parameter. So not quite as good as the Analyst deck, but still relatively respective. And again, you have to take these results with a grain of salt because both these decks only have two pilots. So, you know, it's not quite as high as we need to. One other cool note about this deck, it's playing the full four copies of Shieldred. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Shieldred, great card. I don't think I need to explain to the listeners why Shieldred's good, but it's cool in this deck because you're playing the Insatiable Avarice card, the one that Vampiric Tutors. It says target player draws three and loses three. So if you have a Shieldred in play, you can just force them to draw three and dome them for nine because you get three Shieldred triggers plus the three they lost from the Avarice. So that's kind of cool. Just three mana, deal you nine.
Why not?
Love it.
All right, the next most successful deck was Azorius Artifacts, which had a 60% win rate.
Not bad.
And also had only two pilots.
Yep.
Can you tell me more about this one?
I'll take this one. Sure. Azorius Artifacts. So, yeah, this was the, like you said, two pilots, 60% win rate, so pretty respectable. It might appear at first glance like a traditional control deck where I guess I shouldn't say traditional. That's not the right word. But it's kind of like utilizing, like, mana engines. So you have the mana in the form of Thran Spider and Fabrication Foundry to kind of help jump the curve a little bit. And then this deck also heavily features another new OTJ card in Simulacrum Synthesizer, which is a card that we did discuss on the spoiler episode. And honestly, a card that's kind of been taking off recently. I don't know if you've noticed the price of that card, but it's basically skyrocketed to the moon. I think most of that's due to Legacy and a little bit due to Modern. But yeah, this is playing Synthesizer in Standard. So it's allows you to make a Construct token whenever you play any 3+ mana artifact, which you have quite a bit of, Braided Net, Assimilation Aegis. You have Mightstone and Weakstone to kind of help that as well. And then you also are playing removal spells in the form of Spring-Loaded Sawblades and Glass Casket. And then your sweeper is Unstable Glyph Bridge, which is yet another 5-mana artifact that triggers Synthesizer. So it's kind of developing a lot of extra mana, utilizing artifact removal spells to help bridge the curve, bridge the gap, which also make constructs along the way, and just trying to, you know, amass this giant board presence. This deck looks pretty cool, and I'm definitely going to have to test this one when I start doing my Dallas testing for sure.
Let's look at the top eight, because in some cases the results not really that surprising based on what we know about the popularity of some of these decks from the event. So we had tied for eighth place, Sean Goddard on Teamer Analyst. Sean did have two new cards in the sideboard, a couple of Bonnie Pal Clear Cutter. So in case you're not familiar, I certainly was not. Bonnie Pal is a 6-mana legend giant scout with reach. It's a 6/5. When it enters the battlefield, create Bow, a legendary blue ox creature token with this creature's power and toughness equal to the number of lands you control. Whenever you attack, draw a card, then you may put a land from your hand or graveyard into the battlefield. Is this like an alternate win condition if they're attacking your graveyard?
Yep, you got it exactly. You know, these a lot of these analyst decks were prepared for Rest in Peace. Bonnie Paul and I believe Sean also had one or two copies of Titan of Industry as well, so they were prepared and had additional threats.
All right, also tied for eighth place, Ray Zhang on 4-Color Legends, playing one of the new Vial Smashers and 3 copies of Honest Rutstein. I saw a lot of Honest Rutsteins in these most popular deck lists, and it just seems to be like a really useful in a variety of strategies. For those who don't recall, Honest Rutstein is 1 black-green for a 3/2. When it enters the battlefield, return target creature card from your graveyard to your hand. But it also says creature spells you cast cost 1 less to cast. So I guess it draws you a card and it ramps you on mana.
Yeah, it's really, really sick in these Legends decks. What is also kind of funny, so you'll notice the 1 copy of Vial Smasher. I believe, to my knowledge, there is a loop that you can do with double Honest Rutstein, because the first one makes the second one cost less, and Relic of Legends, and then the Vial Smasher, because Vial Smasher is a card that a lot of you may not know, but it is a 3/2 that says whenever another outlaw enters the battlefield, it deals 1 damage to target opponent, and Honest Rutstein is an outlaw, so you can kind of loop them together with their cost reduction.
It's so cool. All right, up next, still tied for eighth, it's Lucas Dachau, who's playing Esper Midrange, a popular deck featuring 3 Duelists of the Mind.
Love it.
So Nathan Story will exist in the Pro Tour, maybe, even if not in person.
Well, I think the next Pro Tour, I think it's MH3, right? Is the next Pro Tour. So I doubt people are going to be playing Duelist in that one.
Hey, you never know. Still tied for eighth, we have Jason Ye on 4-Color Legends. This one featured 1 copy of the new Tiny Bones, in addition to Vial Smasher and Honest Rutstein. Tiny Bones, an expensive card. 1 black mana for a 1/1 Death Toucher. When it deals combat damage to a player, you may cast target non-land permanent card from that player's graveyard, and mana of any type can be spent to cast that spell. This is a $25 card. I don't get it.
I don't either. I guess it's maybe maybe it's EDH. It is a mythic rare. It's legendary, so the price would, I assume, EDH, but I don't think it's that great. You have to see 1 copy here. I've tried it in Pioneer. It hasn't been super great. Don't think it's really doing anything in Modern, so.
Okay, tied for 4th place, Arnie Hushenbeth on Esper Midrange. It's got some sideboard pest controls, no other new cards there. And then also tied for 4th, Takumi Matsura on Boros Convoke, playing, obviously, Inspiring Vantage, no new cards otherwise. Our finals were between Yuta Takahashi on Azorius Control and Yoshihiko Ikawa on Domain Ramp. Domain Ramp won the event with a very stock-looking list. No new cards that I noticed. Meanwhile, Yuta on Azorius Control, tons of new cards. We got 2 Phantom Interference, 4 copies of 3 Steps Ahead, all the counterspells.
Yeah, definitely. The I'm not a huge fan of Azorius Control in Standard. Yuta, obviously a stone cold master. Not surprising to see him do well with a deck like this. And I did get to watch a little bit of Yuta play the finals matchup, and Three Steps Ahead looked pretty good whenever he had it. So that card is definitely here to stay, especially in these control decks.
How was he using it? Like, primarily a counterspell? Is he managing to spree it for more effects because the games are going so long?
Most of the time that I saw him cast it, it was on turn five, and he would just go counterspell plus loot. That was the most common play pattern, because you can no moralize or get lost their early plays and then set up for that on five. And I think that's kind of like counterspell draw card is, you know, it's for five mana, you're paying a lot, but you know, the games do go long, like you said, and it's pretty good in that role.
I would imagine that the Azorius Controls on Pioneer can probably adopt that same play. It's like an expensive and worse cryptic command, but Pioneer is an expensive and worse format by and large, right?
I mean, people are playing Absorb, right? You know, you don't get the life, true. But you get the additional mode of being able to draw a couple cards. And like, you can imagine draw two, discard one, pretty good to fueling dig through time. So I can see it.
Mm-hmm. He does have another spree counterspell that I mentioned, Phantom Interference, which also has a five mana play where you can, for five mana, Quelch and create a 2/2 spirit flyer.
You remember this old card? It's four mana for a 2/2 flash when it ETBs and counters a spell.
Venser?
No, Mystic Snake.
Oh, Mystic Snake, duh.
Five mana Mystic Snake. We gave it flying, so I guess I'll take that.
Oh, I'm sure that's great. All right. Congratulations to Yoshihiko Ikawa on the win.
One more thing real quick before we get out of the top eight. I did a Pro Tour fantasy draft, and I had Lucas and Ray on my team, and I was very, very close to taking Ikawa in the last round. So I could have had three people in the top eight on my team with one of them being the winner. So just humble brags.
Oh, what did you get in your fantasy draft for only having two?
Well, I won.
Oh, nice.
I still won. Yeah, no, but I think there was nobody else. Like, the people who had individuals in top eight, the rest of their team didn't do so well. So.
Well, congrats to you too, then. Devin, I'm sure that's what you're fishing for. So one of the things that I want to wrap this conversation up with is our win matrices. Because one of the things that we got from Wizards was actual win rates against other decks, as well as overall win rates from the weekend. But afterward, we had a whole weekend of standard tournaments online and in paper, including the Pro Tour and twitter.com/mtgjax, which does a lot of the matrices we talk about on the show, actually compiled a four tournament weekend of standard matrix for us to look at that had 2,534 matches. So a sizable sample size. And the bit that I wanted to pay closest attention to is, what's the difference between the Pro Tour performing decks and the overall weekend metagame? Just to see, is anything stand out as like hugely different, or are things mostly lining up? And in general, things mostly lined up with a handful of exceptions. So we'll talk about those exceptions, and we'll wrap with, what are the best decks possibly moving forward after this weekend based on what we saw in the Pro Tour that was backed up by the MTG Dex account as well? The four decks that had biggest deltas that I saw were Five Color Legends, which had a 54% win rate over the weekend in these four tournaments, but it only had one pilot at the PT who went 1-4. So not the strongest performance there, very small sample size on the PT stage, but actually still probably a decent deck.
The Five Color Legends deck at the PT, do you know if that was Kibler? Because I think he played a similar deck, and I know he didn't do well.
You might be correct.
Yeah, I think it was
Kibler. I did not take that step of confirming who it was.
I think it was. The GOAT.
Kibler. known commander player now.
Yeah, true.
Wow. This is what happens when you go into the commander world. You get worse at one-on-ones constructed.
You just play five color at the PT.
Yeah. Another one that did really well in the PT, but not quite as well over the weekend, was Blue-White Control. And I think that's maybe to be expected. PT caliber players who are drawn to control style decks, they had a 60% win rate at the tournament. Meanwhile, over the weekend at large, only a 54% win rate. Still very good for Control especially, but I think if you're looking at the win rate of Control after the Pro Tour, maybe cool your jets a little bit, because we are talking about some of the best players in the world right now piloting it as efficiently as possible.
Yeah, like you'd in the finals. I there was a match between, I think it was Shota and Shuhei, and it was like, oh my god, it was the fastest Magic I've ever seen in my life. It was wild.
I love playing against Control players who are like racing against the clock by turn three already.
Yeah.
And for me in the RCQ world, like usually I get an edge that way because they're playing sloppy by trying to go as quickly as possible. But I think the Pro Tour players can go fast without much downside. Golgari Mid had a 58% win rate at the Pro Tour, only 50% over the weekend.
Hmm. I mean, it is Golgari mid-range. You know, you would maybe kind of expect it to be right around that 50%. This is just the jund of the format, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I think this is, again, like a nice reminder that the Pro Tour caliber players are in one class. When you increase the sample size and include like a lot more variety among the type of players who are piloting the deck, maybe it's not necessarily busted yet.
Right. And if you look at the decks you have on this list, it's like Control, mid-range Control, like those decks are generally speaking a little bit harder to play, right? Mm-hmm. Unless you're playing with Rafine, then, you know, you can make as many mistakes as you want, but Rafine can carry you. So,
well, speaking of Control, the final deck on my list here is blue-black Control. It only had a 48% win rate at the Pro Tour, but on the weekend at large, it actually had a much more respectable 54%.
Well, there you go. The reverse.
So that's one where, like, yeah, you can consider Dimir Control as maybe a playable deck, even though it didn't necessarily shine in Seattle. All right, that said, final note. What do we think are maybe the best decks to look at moving forward? I've got three, and we've talked about them. Orzhov Bronco and Azorius Artifacts. They looked very good across the weekend, including the Pro Tour, where they had insane win rates of at least 60%. Likewise, Golgari Analyst. Although we only had two pilots, super small sample size, we didn't really have a distinct win rate for the Golgari version across the weekend because I don't think it actually saw that much play. But even the Teamer version had a 54% win rate at the Pro Tour and a 52% across the weekend. So it's still generally positive. And the fact that we saw the Golgari version just crush in Constructed, maybe something to keep an eye on if you're an analyst player and you want to try to evolve moving forward.
Yeah, the decks that I'm going to be playing when I first start doing testing for Dallas is going to be Bronco and Jund Analyst. I think those decks look really cool. I like the innovations that both of them have made with the new set. And, you know, past that, I'm probably going to be doing some more work on Profs because I love that card and have, you know, for better or worse, an infatuation with it. Past that, yeah, there. I know that Mono Red... There was one person on Twitter, I can't remember their name, but somebody won like four trophies in a row with Mono Red and Standard with like Slickshot and Kumano and stuff. So maybe I'll look into Mono Red too.
Nice. All right, well, that wraps up the Pro Tour. We got another one in the bag. Let's hang our hats on that, our cowboy hats, and look at whatever this new set symbol is and talk about Modern Horizons 3 spoilers.
It's not a cowboy hat. I don't know what it is, but...
Yeah, it's like...
It's like an upside-down cowboy hat, maybe? I don't know.
Maybe it's an Eldrazi head shape?
Somebody brought up, it does kind of look similar to the Eldritch Moon Sith symbol, mm-hmm. like the Emrakul, the Promised End one. It does kind of look mm-hmm. like that.
So, Dev, I don't know if you know this, but whenever Modern Horizon sets come out, the Dive Down produces a ton of content. And it's the one... type of product where we actually do a full set review.
Ooh,
we're still going to do that.
Yeah. But we can't not talk about these.
We can't not talk about them. We got to strike while the iron's hot. And some of these are really juicy.
Oh, yeah.
Including this first one. Nethergoyf. A new one drop.
Yeah.
All right. This is single black for a star / one plus star. So we've got the Tarmogoyf stat line for half the mana. Nethergoyf's power is equal to the number of card types among cards in your graveyard, and its toughness is equal to that number plus one. So It's not symmetrical, like the real Tarmogoyf. Does that matter?
Maybe. It depends. So the other part of this is you can escape it for 3 mana to exile any number of other cards from your graveyard with 4 or more card types. So, you know, I guess the escape part maybe doesn't come up as much. The weird thing that I kind of keep coming across with this card is like trying to figure out exactly how to build with it, because normally the cards that self-mill that are mostly creatures, right? Like Stitcher Supplier, Street Wraith, Troll of Khazad-dûm, like there's a lot of creatures, but there's not a lot of other different types that you can get into your deck, because it's a lot of those cards aren't necessarily as efficient at self-milling. I guess you could do like Witherbloom Command, Grizzly Salvage to give you an instant and a sorcery, and then play Bauble and things like that. Maybe the key is that you don't just try to go all in with it and you just play it as, like you said, just a Tarmogoyf that maybe comes back from time to time, because Saga's good with it too. Saga gives you a land mm-hmm. and an enchantment, which is kind of cool. Mm-hmm. I don't know, though. What do you think about this one?
Well, I feel like Modern Horizons 2 taught us that like mythic and not mythic one drops in modern specific sets are worth keeping an eye on. And Ragavan was obviously like an all-star for a really long time. It's still good. Maybe it's not as scary as it used to be. Dragon Rage Channeler, same thing. I think if they're making this a mythic, they probably know that
it's probably a reason.
There's probably a good reason to do that.
Sure.
It's a good point. Might be in high demand. We got to sell packs.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And honestly, like, it really took me an embarrassingly long time to realize that it's asymmetrical. I kept looking at it. I'm like, oh, so they just made Tarmogoyf better. But then,
no, not quite.
Finally, after like 30 minutes of staring at it, I was like, wait, there's the one word difference. And I think from playing against Tarmogoyf for 20 years or so, the Tarmogoyf decks are really good at like putting different card types in their own yard. Yeah. We're running like weird tribal enchantments. Sometimes we're playing baubles or whatever else. And I think getting this to be a 1-mana 3/4 on turn 2 or 3, probably turn 2, is I think going to be a lot easier than maybe we expect. And maybe I'm even underselling it there. Just like turn 1, Fetchland Thoughtseize, turn 2, Bauble, instant, something else. Maybe like something else that self-mills for 1, like whatever that core set 1 drop that when it enters and dies, it mills 3 cards.
Supplier.
Stitcher Supplier, thank you.
Yeah.
Like, that's like, I think by then we're looking at maybe a 3 or larger on turn 2. And I think that might be not bad.
Yeah, it's possible I'm kind of diving or going a little bit too deep into the self-mill stuff. And, you know, it's people who play Tarmogoyf, like you said, they're not specifically trying to mill. They're just playing good cards that just happen to have different types because, you know, like you said, Urza Saga, Thoughtseize, Mishra's Bauble, Street Wraith, Lightning Bolt, there's, you know, 6 different types right there. And that's 5 of the most played cards in the format. So maybe I'm just like not realizing that it's as easy as regular Tarmogoyf, and maybe, like you said, it'll play it a little bit better. I mean, you could even imagine like turn 1, Fetchland, Bauble, Street Wraith, play this. That's just, you know, a 3/4 for 1 mana, and then heaven forbid you have another type and start attacking them for 4 on turn 2. Like that, it can get pretty aggressive.
I love it. The one thing I like about this card is that you no longer have like those awkward feel bads where you try to bolt a Goyf and then accidentally grow it outside of bolt range. I don't think that's going to be a problem here.
Yeah, that is nice.
Maybe that's what they finally fixed.
It's the fixed Goyf. Is that what it is?
I want to talk about one more black card that is actually my favorite card from this first article.
I know where you're going.
And I don't know how to pronounce it. Chthonian Nightmare?
Perfect.
Is that how you would pronounce it too?
Nailed it.
It's 1 and a black for an enchantment. When it enters the battlefield, you get 3 energy counters.
Energy's back.
In Pog form. It also has pay X energy, sack a creature, return Chthonian Nightmare to its owner's hand. return target creature card with mana value X from your graveyard to the battlefield. Activate only as a sorcery. Devin.
Atlanta Tech sounds kind of familiar.
Have you ever played a card called Recurring Nightmare?
No, tell me more.
It's banned in Commander.
True. Very true. Chthonian Nightmare, pre-banned in Commander, maybe?
Oh, God, I hope not, because I've always wanted to play Recurring Nightmare in Commander. I love it in Cube. This is one mana cheaper. It's different, but I think the templating is similar enough that it's very exciting. Recurring Nightmare, for those not familiar, it's 2 and a black for an enchantment, and it's sack a creature, return target Nightmare to its owner's return Nightmare to its owner's hand, put target creature card from your graveyard into play. Play this ability as a sorcery. Fine. This one like has a little bit of a built-in, I guess, limitations. If you're not playing an energy deck, you can only get a 3-mana creature back with it. But the thing about Recurring Nightmare that made it so good they had to ban it Commander is that it sets up like insane loops where it makes it near impossible to kill creatures, and in some cases you can even combo off. This being 1 mana cheaper, regardless of that 3 CMC limitation, let's say this is your only energy source in your deck, I feel like there's enough really good 3-mana cards that produce tokens or generate other ETB values or other death triggers that there's going to be a way to like use this either for value as a failsafe or to do something like bonkers and possibly win on the spot otherwise.
Yeah, I haven't exactly thought about what the actual best thing to get back with it. The thing that immediately came to mind at 3 mana was Grist, where it's like you can have self-mill, the Grist sets up the self-mill. If you mill the Grist over, it then fuels the nightmares again. You can minus the Grist to kill something. You can stitch a supplier, sack the supplier to the Grist. Like there's kind of a shell brewing there. Also good with Bloodghast, because you sack Bloodghast to this, Bloodghast comes back for basically free. You can do it again next turn. But I think, like you said, the key to really unlocking the true power of this card is, I think, finding whatever the best... The card that I want to pair with this is just something good that's 3-mana creature. When it ETBs, do X. Could be mill, could be draw, could be destroy something. That is kind of the way to abuse this, because you can then loop that 3-drop with other creatures and kind of keep doing that over and over again. So, you know, it's not like you said, like normal Nightmare where you're trying to just cheat some giant thing into play. There's a lot more thinking involved with this card. And this is one of my favorite cards in the set. I absolutely love this design.
Do you think they're going to put Ophiomancer into Modern? Will they do it?
Would Ophiomancer even be good?
I mean, it's really good it's pretty good with Recurring Nightmare. Yeah. It's just like this stupid engine that never ends.
I think part of what makes Ophiomancer good in Cube is Black Lotus, and not necessarily Ophiomancer itself.
Mm. Well, maybe they'll put Black Lotus into Modern.
Maybe they'll put Ancient Tomb into Modern, perhaps.
Perhaps. I don't know. I don't know about that one. But yeah, that's I think kind of the interesting thing is like we can start looking at. It doesn't have to be black. It can just be any 3-drop that does something really good on ETB or on death. See if you can create some kind of loop with this new nightmare. And we're off to the races.
Yeah, I wonder if there's like a loop with Stitcher Supplier looping themselves with Thassa's Oracle that you can rebuy the Oracle. I guess I don't know how you get the mana to cast a nightmare in that loop, but I'm sure maybe one of the listeners can figure something out. I'm sure there's a way to do it.
Yeah, I'm looking at my Forge Neverwinter Charlatan Commander deck, which is a mono black sack deck that plays Ophiomancer. And I'm looking to see if there's any other good 3-drops in there. Not seeing them yet, but I guess we have Lord Skitter Sewer King.
Maybe does not have an ETB up or a death, but does make tokens. It's like, is that the fixed Ophiomancer?
Yeah, at the beginning of combat on your turn, you create a rat.
Rats. Can't block.
What else are you liking from the article?
Well, I guess we could... You want to just rip the Band-Aid off? You want to talk about Ugin's Labyrinth?
Oh,
all right. Talk to me. Oh, all right. Oh, boy. All right. For those of listeners who have not heard of this card, Ugin's Labyrinth, it is a land that has imprint. When it enters the battlefield, you may exile a colorless card with mana value 7 or greater from your hand. It has two tap abilities. The first one is tap, add a colorless. If a card is exiled with Ugin's Labyrinth, add 2 colorless instead. Land that taps for 2. I feel like I've seen this before. And you can tap to return the exiled card to its owner's hand.
What the heck?
Dude, I don't know. You're asking me. I don't know what this is.
Who put that last line there? Whose idea was that? Was that Mason?
They're like, if my land gets blown up, I don't want to have the unfortunate downside of losing my card. Yeah, the downside is you got an ancient tomb. You don't need to you know what I mean? Like, you don't need to protect the person who's playing with ancient tomb. Just let their card blow up. I don't know.
Oh, here's the other thing. God. Like, this doesn't even enter tapped. So correct. you could just make an ancient tomb and then just get the card back immediately.
You could do that, yeah. Well, you can't do both in the same turn because they're both tap abilities. But you could, like, ancient tomb, use the mana for, like, turn 1 or turn 2, and then get it back later on.
Sure, but I'm saying, like, let's say you have nothing to spend the 2 mana on when you play this. You can both, play an ancient tomb and then just have the card back in your hand that same turn.
Oh, sure. You can give yourself the option to do it, yeah.
You don't have to keep that card in exile to have an ancient tomb. So it's just like, it's just an ancient tomb with a deck building restriction.
No, you do.
And I don't think when it enters the battlefield, you may exile a colorless card with mana value 7 or greater. If a card is exiled with, so it has to remain in exile.
Once you get the card back, the ancient tomb gets turned off.
Okay. Yep. Okay. Fine.
There's a downside, I guess, if you want to call it a downside.
Okay.
Oh, it's your friend Dave. Pop it back in. I just wanted to be very clear that I could have edited out Stan misunderstanding the rules right there. And because of what happened earlier, I'm not going to do that. Okay, enjoy the rest of these spoilers.
I mean, I don't know. Like, obviously, the big thing that people are talking about is, you know, is this the return of something like Eldrazi Tron? Or it could be some sort of other aggressive Eldrazi deck where you kind of want to play Eldrazi Temple anyways, because that's the other 2-mana land. Those things power out Allisdust. They power out Ulamog, all these, you know, 8-mana cards, 7-mana cards, and both of those work pretty well with Labyrinth. I mean, I think the thing that people are most scared about is the fact that you can just turn 1 Chalice now. Like, there are a lot of decks in Modern. Domain Zoo plays a lot of 1-drops. Prowess plays a lot of 1-drops. Murktide, if people are still playing that. And I don't know. Turn 1 Chalice of the Void, kind of scary. Kind of scary. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This is a thought that I haven't even thought twice about because it just entered my brain. Maybe you can help me think this out, but is this like doing Simeon Spirit Guide things possibly? Like, is there a way you can use this not in like a big mana deck per se, but in like some kind of combo deck just to be able to like get an extra mana out early in almost like Gemstone or Spirit Guide fashion?
Trying to think, it doesn't quite work with the Cascade cards because it makes colorless, so you can't like turn to Shardless or turn to Ardenplay or anything like that. I mean, I guess you could turn to Blood Moon, but then that shuts off the Ancient Tomb. You could do like Red Prison things, right, where you have this in your opening hand, you pitch some random card, you can go turn 1 Chalice, turn 2 Blood Moon, and, you know, do like a prison style thing with Karn. I've heard, again, this is kind of the maybe magical Christmas land, but if you have Sign of Draco plus Leyline, you can go reveal Leyline, start the game with it, play Labyrinth, exile a Scion, and then tap the Labyrinth for 2 to play another Scion from your hand on turn 1. Now that's going a little too deep because, you know, you need to have 2 Scions and the Leyline and the Labyrinth, but you can theoretically do that. Would I recommend doing that? Probably not, but it is cool.
Coming soon to a Doom Extreme near you.
I'm going to play the hell out of this card. I'm going to play a lot of Eldrazi decks, and I'm probably going to beat a lot of people with this card. That I can assure you.
So we have a new free counterspell, and we already have the screenshots of is this card busted, followed by this card is not good. The duality of Magic players.
We have the receipts.
Obviously, the duality is talking about a counterspell. Flare of Denial. One blue, counter target spell. You may sacrifice a non-token blue creature rather than play the spell's mana cost. Non-token. That line always trips me up. I'm just like, oh, I can do this and that and this and that. But it's like, no, it has to actually be a card.
Probably good that they specified non-token.
Yes, yes. I bet that was very important to actually like make sure this cycle wasn't insane.
Yeah.
And, you know, we saw the green version from the cycle during MC Chicago.
Flare of Cultivation.
Yeah, which is like a naturalize that has that.
Rampant Growth.
Oh, it's a Rampant Growth?
Or it's it's Cultivate. Right, it's Cultivate.
It's Cultivate?
Sorcery speed, Cultivate, but you sack green creature.
All right, thanks. This is a counterspell. So, I mean, it's probably going to be at least fine, if not actively good, in blue X creature strategies that need to protect themselves from something.
Yeah, I would imagine this slots right into Merfolk. That's the obvious mm-hmm. home where they're already playing a bunch of, you know, somewhat mediocre one mana blue creatures that they may or may not want on the battlefield. So this is kind of like, it's sort of like the reverse subtlety where, you know, subtlety, you have to keep the extra spell in hand. But what's what I like about Flare, you always find yourself in these spots, and maybe you know this as a Rhinos player, where you have like a blue card in hand, maybe it's a Shardless Agent, and you want to cast it. But then if you cast the agent, you're going shields down on your subtlety. And this is kind of the perfect medium where you can just cast all of your spells and it doesn't matter if they don't play a spell that you want to counter, then okay, fine, I'm just going to keep attacking you. And then you have the out clause where you don't have to keep the spell in your hand. So, I mean, in Merfolk, it seems really, really good. I'm not sure what else it would do outside of that, but it definitely seems good in that deck.
Well, I also feel like we shouldn't trap ourselves into what we expect out of Modern, because at least with MH2 and I think this was the case with MH1 as well, like the format changed so significantly. I think Modern Horizon sets produce new strategies, period.
Oh yeah.
So like maybe we'll have a new Merfolk set, but maybe we'll find some other like creature aggro or mid-range deck that runs blue that can run this too. And you know, I'm never one to think about like what's the home for cards, because I just think a good card will find a home. I think that's especially true of Modern Horizon sets, because like the influx of power just has so many possible directions to go that it's almost difficult to predict where things happen, and they always find a way to surprise me.
Yeah, we're going to take a quick detour here, just like a 2-minute tangent. So I have a bit of a gripe with this card, and it's not necessarily this card specifically, but it's the design of free spells, right? So if you look at MH1, green has Force of Vigor, which is destroy mm-hmm. artifacts or enchantments, Endurance, Graveyard Hate, new green card, Cultivate. All three of those are very different designs, right? Black, yes. You have Force of Despair, kill some creatures, Grief, Thought Seize You. Relatively different yes. designs.
Yes.
Red, MH1, you have make some creatures, fury, kill some creatures, different designs. White, you have Anthem and Swords to Plowshares, extremely different designs, right? So then yeah. Let's take a look at blue, Stan. What does blue give us in MH1? It gave us
a counterspell.
Okay. How about MH2? Basically a counterspell. Yeah. And then how about MH3? Oh, look, another counterspell. Like, can they just let blue something do different than countering a spell? There's got to be some other design here, right? I don't know.
The other design is draw three cards. Is that what you want?
Well, no, not necessarily, but I would like something a little bit different than another counterspell that looks different. I don't know. Maybe that's just me, but...
Yeah. I mean, why fix something that isn't broken?
Like, yeah, I mean, it's a cool design. I'm not hating on the card or the design itself. I just kind of wish that there was some, like, a different texture to blue cards, you know?
Mm-hmm. The children, they just want to counter spells.
They really do.
Give the children what they want.
Yeah. You want to talk about another blue card? Perhaps a turtle of sorts?
Oh, sure.
Hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. This was a surprise for me,
I will say. It was a surprise for me as well. So let's read the card for the listeners at home. It's called Kappa Cannoneer. If you're familiar with Legacy, you probably know this card. But for those of you who don't, it's 5 and a blue for a 4/4 artifact creature, Turtle Warrior. Excellent creature type. It has Improvise, which basically is like sort of affinity. It says your artifacts can help cast this spell. Each artifact you tap after you're done activating mana abilities pays for a colorless. So Improvise is different from like affinity. If you think of a Mirror Enforcer, it has 7 mana. Your affinity, if 7 artifacts, you cast it for free. You can't reduce. You always have to pay blue for this. You can never cast this for free. It's something to keep in mind. It is a 4/4 with ward 4. That's a lot. Good luck killing that thing. And whenever Kappa Cannoneer or another artifact enters the battlefield under your control, put a +1/+1 counter on Kappa Cannoneer, and it can't be blocked this turn. This one's a shocker to me. Again, we don't like to discuss leaks, but I did happen to take a look at some of the leaks, and this was one of the cards on that page. And I was like, surely this has to be in the Commander set. There's no way they would put this card into Modern. And I mean, here we are, you know. We've seen a lot of the affinity decks pop up recently, Stan, and those decks are playing a lot of the Simulacrum Synthesizers. This is a 6-mana card that works well with that. It also gets +1/+1 counters when the synthesizer tokens come into play, and the fact that it's unblockable, and the fact that, you know, for all intents and purposes, Ward 4 is basically hexproof. You're not killing this thing ever. Card seems sick.
Yeah, this is really fun. And it's also worth noting that you can play this in the same decks as affinity strategies, so you can almost get like the best of both worlds just to produce a lot of bodies for as little mana as possible. The only question I have is, like, is Thought Monitor enough to kind of keep you in the game? Probably.
Yeah, I would say so.
Thought Monitor plus Urza Saga, like, probably just like will generate enough card advantage that the Cannoneer will beat down fast enough.
Yeah, so the way
before you run out of cards.
The way that people do it in Legacy is they play 8 Thoughtcast, right? So they play 4 Thoughtcast, 4 Thought Monitor. And the idea is you're chaining those into more free artifacts. Right now, Legacy is different beast. They have Urza's Bauble, Mox Opal. They have more zeros than we do Lotus Petal. So it's a little bit different, but we still have Mishra's Bauble, we have Frogmite, Mirror Enforcer, Sojourner's Companion, and notably, all of those also trigger the Synthesizer, which then also pumps the Cannoneer more. Like, I could legitimately see, if you can chain enough Thoughtcasts and Thought Monitors together, you could potentially, with a good draw, you could maybe kill somebody on turn 3 with this.
Ooh.
There's probably a way to do it. Yeah, I mean, your draw has to be very good, obviously, but... yeah, this card seems really good, especially like you said, when you're chaining those Thought Monitors and all, and just casting more Mirror Enforcers and triggering Synthesizer, and Urza Saga tokens also pump this. And I think the biggest delta with this card is figuring out how many cheap artifacts you want. Like, do you want, you know, 4 Springleaf, 4 Moonsnare, how many Memnites, how many Ornithopters, how many Baubles, things like that. Like, finding that right balance. But yeah, there's enough top end and enough chains that I think this card has the potential to be really good.
I think you also have to ask yourself how many Ugin's Labyrinth you want in this deck.
Because that too.
Affinity can play 7 drops.
Yep.
Right? That's kind of the point. So,
yeah, if you're going to play 4 Enforcer and 4 Sojourner's Companion, then you probably just want to be playing 4 of the Labyrinth.
Yeah, this is exciting. There's another artifact that caught my eye. A moon.
The moon.
The moon. The winter moon. 2 mana for an artifact. Players can't untap more than 1 non-basic land during their untap step. So it's not Winter Orb. It's not Blood Moon. It's somehow more annoying than both of them, maybe.
It's Blood Orb.
It's Blood Orb. I mean, this just seems like a really cool hate piece. And I can see this in some cases being able to all but lock an opponent out, because there's so many strategies that play 1 or 2 basics and that's it.
Yep. Yeah. Especially the Domain Zoo decks. They're like, I don't even know if they have a basic anymore. Yeah. Like you said, very good surgical sideboard card. I thought about it. Like I kind of went through this initial phase of, you know, I read it. I was like, oh my God, they put Winter Orb in Modern. And then I read it again. And I was like, okay, maybe it's not as good as I thought on first read. But also you could, I don't know what the context of the deck would look like, but you could potentially main deck this card in something like a mono red goblins or a mono blue merfolk, where you're, I guess even those decks have a lot of non-basics because they play mutavaults and caverns and all this stuff. So maybe even in those decks, you won't want to play it. So yeah, it's like you said, it's probably just a sideboard card, but it is a good sideboard card at that. Very good against like Omnath decks, Tron, Scion of Draco, that kind of stuff.
Do you have to be in like a mono color strategy to not get blown out by this too? Or I guess like you just do the same thing you do against Blood Moon decks, or like when you're playing a Blood Moon, you just, you fetch around it and maybe you play both, like, and you have like a kind of a mini rule of eight. If you're playing Blood Moon and Winter Moon, if you draw extras, you just ditch them with Fable of the Mirror Breaker or something.
I almost wonder if there's a way to do like we were talking about Mono Red Prison earlier with the turn one Labyrinth, turn two Blood Moon thing. I wonder if there's, like you said, rule of eight, where it's like Blood Moon, Winter Moon, utilizing the Labyrinth as your fast mana, and then parlay the hate pieces like Chalice, Moon, Moon, and parlay that into stuff like Karn and, you know, the normal, like maybe Trinisphere, things like that. So there maybe could be a prison deck with this, but then I guess the Winter Moon is a little bit awkward with the Labyrinth because it is a non-basic land, so things to think about.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll let someone else think about it. We're just going to use our Mana Trader subscriptions to rent them when this figured out. All right, so the last card from this batch of spoilers that we want to talk about today is a familiar friend that's similar but different than an old friend.
Yeah, it was actually this particular character that was on an episode of The Walking Dead and no longer with us.
Yeah. I love, my favorite part about Modern Horizons isn't the power. It's not the more expensive booster packs. It's the puns. Because even when the cards aren't good, the puns always hit home. And this is very punny. And that's White of the Reliquary. Black, green for a 2/2. It's like an Akasha or Ashaka Death Dealer. Remember that old
Rakshasa cat? Oh, yeah.
Rakshasa. That's the one.
Oh, yeah.
This, though, is a Zombie Knight, 2/2 Vigilance. It gets +1/+1 for each creature card in your graveyard. And it also has tap, sack another creature, search your library for a land, put it on the battlefield tap, then shuffle.
Card sweet.
Knight of the Reliquary, not really a modern playable card.
No.
I think, sadly, for a lot of people. Do you think we just had to flip it and reverse it to make it good?
Well, we also, I think, had to shave a mana off of it, right? The fact that this costs 2 as opposed to 3. 2 is a lot different than 3 in today's modern. What's really cool about this card, there's a couple of things that I like going on here. So, first of all, the Vigilance, which is really cool because you get to play offense while you're playing defense, and like you can also attack and use the ability, so you kind of get the best of both worlds. I don't know how much you played with Knight of the Reliquary, but there was always kind of that tension where it's like you have 4 or 5 lands in your graveyard that you want to attack for 6, but you also kind of want to get some more value, and with this, you just get to do both of them, which I think is a really cool addition to Knight of the Reliquary. The other thing that's really cool about this, the fact that it has Vigilance, a common line with Knight decks was like you would Knight up a Sigiri Step to give protection from something. And if your White is big enough, you can go the Vigilance portion, you can go attack with White after attacks before blockers, use it, sack, go get the Sigiri Step, and then go from there. So that's kind of cool. Another card that we've been talking about this all day, but these cards are all these graveyard cards, good with Stitcher Supplier. Very, very good with that. If you're playing a bunch of creatures, the one kind of like deck building decision, I guess, that you have to make is you have to, I guess if you want to play a bunch of utility lands, it's maybe a little, depending on what those utility lands are, you maybe want to, you can be focused more on the land aspect or the creature aspect. I guess the interesting part about this card is finding the ways to bridge the gap, like a land that mills or something like that, you know?
I wonder if this is the type of card that needs to bring like a Crab Vine or a Vengevine deck back. We have like old shells for graveyard creature decks that aren't dredge, and you know, probably, this is probably not a Hogak, but we also haven't, like, apart from Living End, we haven't really seen a strong graveyard deck in a while. And I love the idea of kind of filling the graveyard, not necessarily playing an all-in recursive deck, but like finding a way to get value out of putting creatures in the yard, playing a mostly creature-based deck at it. And then there's probably some added benefit you can get out of sacking creatures.
Bloodgeist.
Either their death effects, or to your point, like if we're playing this with Bloodgeist, then you sack a creature that you can just get back anyway.
Yep. Because then you get the land off the white, which gets back the Bloodgeist, and then it just kind of, you know, there's a lot of synergy there. The other cool thing, I don't, you know, Knight decks in the past have played the Retreat to Coral Helm. So there is a cool line where you go like this plus Retreat plus Bloodgeist. If you milled over a Bloodgeist already, you can go use the white, tap, sack, you know, sack your Bloodgeist, go get a land, get back the Bloodgeist. The land untaps the white, and then you could just do that ad nauseum, right? You just do that infinitely. So it's very similar to the Knight plus Retreat lineup earlier, but you have to have a Bloodgeist mixed in, which is, you know, I mean, you can mill one over. It's not that hard to get a Bloodgeist in the graveyard. So that could be a cool aspect too. And it's nice that if you're playing Retreat, that adds blue to your deck, which, as you mentioned, you kind of maybe want to do anyways with that Crabvine stuff, where you have, like, you know, utilizing Supplier, which is very good with this because it's a sack outlet that also mills, and it's a cheap creature for Vengevine. Mill over Bloodgeist. There's definitely a stew there, and I like the there's a lot of things you can do with this card.
You can even play with Satoru the Infiltrator.
Mm-hmm. Get a Dryad Arbor off this, draw a card off Satoru. Now we're cooking.
Get some, or I was just thinking some Narcomoebas and Bloodgeist.
I hadn't thought about Narcomoeba with Satoru. That's kind of hot.
All right, so this is exciting. A really great aperitif of new cards before spoiler season officially kicks off in a few weeks.
Oh, yeah.
We did it. We did it. We talked about new cards. We talked about a big new tournament. I think this was a great episode.
Yeah, I liked it a lot. I'm, you know, with the spoilers that we've seen today, I am very, you know, I had my doubts a little bit about, you know, I've kind of been vocal about my stance on Modern and Horizon sets in the past, but with the cards that I've seen today, it's certainly shaping up to be a banger. So,
Devin, do you think this is the best episode you and I have ever done together, one on one?
Yes, I think. Okay. I don't remember the other episode we did one on one, but
the other episode we did one on one, we talked about one of your Modern Unplugged tournaments. I think it was your second to last
one. Oh, now I remember that. Okay. That was cool.
Yeah. It was cool. But Modern Horizons, kind of the antithesis of that episode, I know, in a way.
Yeah. we've come full circle.
And so has this episode. Let's wrap up this week's show. If you haven't yet, make sure you subscribe to our podcast to get the latest episodes as soon as they come out. And if you use Apple Podcasts, please leave us a rating and review. You can also subscribe to Devin at twitch.tv/doomwake, D00M wake. I'm not spelling it again until next week. If you'd like to submit a question to our podcast or just reach out in general, you can tweet us at thedivedown, all one word, or email thedivedown@gmail.com. If you'd like to support our show, you can do that at patreon.com/thedivedown. And check out thedivedown.com/store. Head over to heavyplay.com to get some incredible deck and dice boxes and playmats featuring my favorite magnet equip mag system. If you use promo code thedivedown2024, it'll get you 10% off your first order at Heavy Play. Also, shout out to Mana Traders for sponsoring the Dive Down. Sign up for Mana Traders using promo code thedivedown_K4L. It's all one word, and it gets you 10% off your first 2 months of renting Magic Online cards. As always, special thanks to the bands Nowhere and Spaceblood for letting us use their music. Until next week, get out there and save your money until MH3, because you're gonna spend it then.